Hey, good afternoon, Juno. It's about 7 seconds before 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. This is Juno Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today, and I have a wonderful lineup of guests coming your way today. We'll be talking with some folks from UAS first on the show who are wrapping up a long-running thing. I think it's run about 2 or 3 weeks or through the semester. And this is a program on transgenerational suffering. So Saul Neely and Dr. Monica Osborne, a visiting professor, will be here, and we'll talk to them first. And then Kim Naylor will be coming in from the Juneau Douglas City Museum. There's an interesting program there where they have a whole bunch of old photographs of the Juneau Douglas Little Theater, and they're asking folks to come in and help identify the players. The McCrae Sisters, this year's Alaska Folk Festival dance artists, will be here, and we'll also hear a special edition of Bird Note featuring students from Gustavus. And finally, we'll also have the guest caller, Carolyn Oakley, will be joining us for a brief moment. Weather looks like, you saw what the wind did. It blew most of those clouds away, and we have locally windy, but it's still mostly cloudy out there. Highs around 46 today. Northwest winds 10 to 20 miles per hour, those mostly gusting down near Juneau and Douglas. But northeast winds 15 miles per hour with gusts up to 40, so batten down the hatches a little bit. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows 27. Saturday, partly cloudy, highs around 41 again, so it looks like we've got nights just below freezing and days about 10 degrees above. National Native News is next, and then we will get underway with our guests. Stay tuned.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The country's highest court is set to decide whether a child with a Cherokee father or the parents who tried to adopt her will be her permanent home. As KGOU's Kirk Wartney reports, the court will begin oral arguments in the case next week.
The case before the court is adoptive couple versus baby girl. Matt and Melanie Capabianco were chosen by Veronica's mother for an adoption. Veronica's biological father, Dustin Brown, is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma. His attorney says Brown was not properly notified of the planned adoption, and the adoption process violated the Federal Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA. South Carolina courts ruled in favor of Brown, and he was granted custody of the child. There are several legal issues in the case, including whether a non-custodial parent, the father in this case, can invoke the Indian Child Welfare Act to block an adoption by a non-Native American parent. The case could also address the potential conflicts between state laws on the definition of a parent and the requirements of the federal ICWA. The U.S. Supreme Court is scheduled to hear oral arguments in the case Tuesday. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Wartney in Oklahoma City.
The U.S. Senate this week confirmed the nomination of Sally Jewell to serve as Secretary for the Department of the Interior. She's the top executive of the outdoor company REI. President Obama said in a statement that Jewell is the right person for the job. He pointed to her extensive business experience and background in energy and conservation. The president went on to say she believes in the government-to-government relationship with Indian country. She's replacing Ken Salazar, who stepped down. A group of Native and non-Native women are walking along the Mississippi River to raise awareness about water pollution. Sharon Day is the executive director for the Indigenous Peoples Task Force. She says the problem is many people are not connected to the water.
We are water. We are water, and we're of the water. And the Mississippi is a major artery on Turtle Island, the Mama Key on our Mother Earth. And what happens to the water happens to us. If we don't have clean sources of drinking water, none of us will survive.
Day says tribes along the way have supported their effort, like the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, the Ho-Chunk Nation, and the Prairie Island Indian Community. The Mississippi River Water Walk started March 1st in Minnesota and will end in Louisiana. The five women expect to reach their final destination by the end of April. A group of volunteers is organizing a reunion in Sheridan, Wyoming for the Miss Indian America pageant winners from 1953 to 1984. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov reports.
The pageant was held in Sheridan in those years until financial woes moved the event to North Dakota. It finally ended a few years later. The pageant was initially started by civic-minded Sheridan residents to help counter racism against Indian people in the town. Historian Gregory Nickerson is helping organize the event. He says a lot of shops in Sheridan had signs up saying, "No Indians served here," or "No Indians or dogs allowed."
These local history events that really shine a light on how American culture has tried to deal with the conquest that happened in the American West. It's pretty curious that it ended up being a blend of powwow, rodeo, beauty pageant, it had its successes, and it had a noble approach that I think showed some of the best of American values.
Nickerson says the signs did come down, but there were also shortcomings, like starting out with an all-white jury to judge the Indian contestants, and disagreements over what attire the women should wear. Each year's winner lived in Sheridan for a year and traveled around the country in a public relations role, educating people about contemporary Indian issues. For National Native News, I'm Irina Zhorov.
During this month in 2007, Amnesty International released a report showing Native women were 2.5 times more likely to be raped or sexually assaulted. The report also showed an overwhelming number of those crimes were committed by non-Native men. This year, Amnesty applauded the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. Measures were included in the act to help with prosecutions. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Pawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's about 6 minutes and 20 seconds after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO in Juneau, Alaska, and we're going to be talking as our first guests today on a Juneau afternoon with two folks, one from UAS, UAS faculty member Saul Neely, who came to the faculty, I think, what, about 3 years ago?
Yeah, that's right. This is the end of my fourth year.
Right. Okay. And since Saul arrived on the campus, he's been a total rabble-rouser. And recently he put together an honors program, I think almost single-handedly. There had been talk of an honors program for the I was with the university for 8 years, and I think that whole time there was discussion of honors programs, but it took somebody coming from outside with a big stick to get it actually moving. And then my other guest is a wonderful person from out of town. Dr. Monica Osborne is here as part of the honors program's series of discussions on transgenerational suffering. Dr. Monica Osborne is with the Glaser Institute at Pepperdine University, and she specializes in Jewish studies, which we had a little bit of pre-microphone open talk about here. So you're giving a talk tonight as kind of like the wrap-up piece of the series that started April 3rd on transgenerational mm-hmm. suffering. And what's your topic?
Well, I'm going to be talking about the different ways in which we, as a culture, are representing the Holocaust and other collective tragedies. And it's really not so much about how we're representing it, but why we're representing it, but how we're representing it, and whether or not it's ethical to represent the tragedies and atrocities experienced by other people.
In the brief write-up that explained what you were going to be talking about, you used the word non-representational mm-hmm. Showing or something like mm-hmm. that. And I'm wondering what you meant by that.
Well, a great example of a representational approach to trauma would be one of the many Holocaust films that we've seen come out in the past decade, right? And Holocaust films seem to come out all the time. That would be a representational approach. But a non-representational approach to the Holocaust might be simply if you go to the Holocaust Museum, you might see the big pile of hair, shorn hair. Something like that is non-representational because it's not representing or recreating the traumatic event. It actually is an extension of it. And in many ways, I think that's a more compelling way to understand the trauma rather than trying to recreate it artistically. Of course, that's not to say that artistic attempts to respond to the Holocaust are unethical. It's just that, it can be a little bit tricky. And I think what sometimes happens is we distance ourselves from the very event that we're trying to understand by trying to recreate it.
I guess one of the things that I hark back to is the idea of representing an automobile accident in photographs by a boot in the middle of the road, not the car with the dead bodies in it. And I think that's an example of what you're talking about. Is that right?
Right, right. It really is. And, especially by this point, we're about 70 years out from the end of World War II and the events of the Holocaust. And so we've seen hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of photographs of corpses piled high, of crematoria, of all sorts of, you know, gruesome images. And I think, I think it gets to a certain point where we become desensitized to those images, and yet we still don't understand why the Holocaust happened at all. So I think what I'm looking at, is this question of how can we get at the heart of the trauma more authentically and ethically.
And I guess I'm wondering how this ties together, because Saul's program, the sequence that started April 3rd, was about transgenerational suffering. Is the tie here because we are looking back, and so through the generations? Am I getting,
yeah, that's
getting
right.
The connection.
So we started the symposium on April 3rd. It was actually a pre-symposium film screening of Hotel Terminus, Marcel Ofoul's 4.5-hour-long documentary. And Hotel Terminus is a good one because, like Landsman's The Shoah, they don't actually use any archival footage of the Holocaust in their films, right? So these documentaries that are incredibly compelling adopt precisely this non-representational mode, right? Theodor Adorno famously said to write poetry after Auschwitz is barbaric. He qualified that later on. But I think that's the real concern here is against trying to represent the Holocaust because it invests it, you know, representational attempts attempt to invest it with meaning. And this is meaningless suffering that we're contending with. So from Hotel Terminus to Monica's presentation tonight, we're dealing with issues of representation, historical memory, right? This is how we represent these violences is a part of this conversation on historical memory and repair as well. And we have been able to talk about these issues, not just with the Holocaust, but over multiple contexts of genocide and war.
When you say we have been able to talk about, who has participated in the seminar?
Well, we had Friday evening, a week ago, we had Martin Matusik and Patricia Huntington come up from Arizona State University, and they gave some public lectures. But then the following Monday evening, we had a centerpiece event at UAS, and students who are in the Honors Reading Seminar hosted a community discussion on these questions. And the students picked up this question of historical violence, memory, and repair, as it addresses, the situatedness of the university, for instance, on Tlingit land. You know, what does it mean to study at this site of historical violence? What are our responsibilities? And so the students opened up an incredible conversation. Last Monday evening was just completely magical. And then we're wrapping things up tonight with Monica, who is going to bring us from Holocaust actually to post 9/11 issues as well.
Monica, have you been following the sequence of events since April 3rd, or are you coming in kind of with a summary from Saul, or how's that work?
Well, no, I've been checking in from time to time and getting really excited about what has been happening here as part of this symposium. I'm excited to be here at the tail end of it.
In your experience doing Jewish studies at a major university, where there would be a large number of traditional age students, I would imagine, Pepperdine, is this real to them? Do 20-year-olds? My kids have trouble believing in some of the presidents that I can name, you know, and I'm wondering how real these events are to them.
It's a really good question. I find that my students are very invested in discussions of trauma. And I think that may have something to do with, as Americans, we are, it's been, a little over 10 years since 9/11. And in some ways, we are still dealing with our own trauma here in this country. So I think that discussions about trauma and how we respond to trauma, whether it's ours or somebody else's, are even more important to students right now. That said, I'm always amazed at, the lack of knowledge when it comes to events like the Holocaust. I take it for granted that everybody knows about the Holocaust. Everybody knows what happened, but they don't.
Yeah, the people who broadcast the first radio broadcasts from the scenes of the camps are dead now.
Right.
And if any soldiers survive from that period, they're in their 90s. Mm-hmm. So it's a question of I guess, two questions. One is, can it be made real? And I guess the second one is, does it need to be? In other words, what does it do to our society if we understand this? I guess that's my question.
Right.
Is it the fear of repeating history or what?
I think there's that, but you know, the thing about the Holocaust is that, you know, there's been such a wealth of scholarship that has come out of Holocaust studies, and I think that you know, beyond learning about the Holocaust, these studies and these projects help us understand other genocides and other you know, collective tragedies, and help us figure out how to respond to them, and also you know, help us figure out how we need to. What we need to do to be a responsible human being so that these kinds of things don't happen again.
Well, they do happen again. One of the horrifying things, I think, is the fact that I can't imagine a time since I've been growing up when there was not a Holocaust going on that someone had labeled as a genocide. But there are
right.
From Africa to Thailand to every other country in the world, there are these constant attempts to stamp out a group of people. So the lesson of history certainly needs to be learned, and learned well.
Right.
Well, you'll be talking tonight on this topic at 7 o'clock in Egan Lecture Hall. This is the closing lecture. This is open to the public.
Absolutely. Free and open
right.
to the public.
Okay, good. So 7 o'clock tonight, Egan Lecture Hall up on the university campus. Here, Dr. Monica Osborne from Glaser Institute at Pepperdine University delivering the closing starting off, I guess. Are you going to be talking with the public a little bit too as well, opening up for questions?
I am, yes.
Okay, so
yes.
Continuing the dialogue, I guess, would be another
Absolutely.
Way to put it. Okay, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Great, thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 12th of April, 2013. It was on this day, 1633, Galileo Galilei stood trial before the Roman Inquisition to defend the publication of his book, Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems. It all started 90 years before, when the Polish astronomer Copernicus published his book, which laid out his revolutionary theory that the Earth and other celestial objects rotate around the sun. It was at odds with the accepted understanding, which the Church promoted, that the Earth was at the center. Copernicus died about the same time he published his book, so he never got into trouble. But Galileo was already famous. He was a respected scientist, one of the first to show that math could be used to explain the laws of nature, and to show that falling objects accelerate at a uniform rate regardless of their weight. He was interested in Copernican theory, but what proved it was the telescope. A Dutch eyeglass maker invented it, 1608, and Galileo got one, and he saw that the moon was illuminated by a reflection of the sun from the earth, and that Jupiter was orbited by its moons. And he studied Venus and realized that the only explanation for its changing phases was that it orbited the sun. The Church held that the earth was the center of the universe, based on a verse in the book of Joshua that describes God stopping the sun in the sky, and a verse in the Psalms that says the earth was put on its foundations and would not move. Galileo felt that the truth of the Bible was not always literal, that it used metaphorical imagery as well. And he wrote, "I do not feel obliged to believe that the same God who has endowed us with senses, reason, and intellect has intended us to forego their use. He would not require us to deny sense and reason in physical matters which are set before our eyes." And so, April 1533, Galileo was called before the Inquisition in Rome. He was almost 70 years old. He was in poor health. He was condemned. He was put under house arrest. A few years later, he became blind. He died in 1642. The Church did not lift its ban on Galileo's book until 1829. 22. Gustave Flaubert's first novel, Madame Bovary, was published on this day, 1857, about a woman who takes on multiple affairs to stave off the boredom of her empty existence. The novel caught the attention of the authorities, and Flaubert was charged with corrupting public morals. He was acquitted, and the publicity from the trial made the book a bestseller. Here's a poem for today by Dana Joya. Thanks for remembering us. The flowers sent here by mistake, signed with a name that no one knew, are turning bad. What shall we do? Our neighbor says they're not for her, and no one has a birthday near. We should thank someone for the blunder. Is one of us having an affair? At first we laugh, and then we wonder. The iris was the first to die, enshrouded in its sickly sweet and lingering perfume. The roses fell one petal at a time, and now the ferns are turning dry. The room smells like a funeral. But there they sit, too much at home, accusing us of some small crime, like love forgotten, and we can't throw out a gift we've never owned. Dana Joya's poem, Thanks for Remembering Us, from Daily Horoscope, published by Grey Wolf Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Joy Biles, be well, do good work, keep in touch.
About 22 minutes after 3 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. We're in the middle of Juneau afternoon, and my next two guests are here to tell us about periodically, the City Museum does a wonderful thing called Coffee and Collections. And these two ladies, Kimberly Naylor and Alicia Jones, are here to tell us about a really interesting one that's coming up. I don't have the date and time here. When is this?
This is this Saturday, so tomorrow, April 13th, from 10:30 to noon.
Okay, so you come in for coffee and you sit around, and what they've got is they've got a grant so that they can bring out a whole bunch of playbills, posters, tickets, photographs that are associated with the Juneau Douglas Little Theater.
Yes.
Evidently, we're nearing their 50th anniversary or?
Just past it.
Just past, yes. Okay. But this is the biggest thing about this is, like a lot of these pictures, they're snaps, and we don't know exactly who's in there, right?
That's right. So we have a collection of photographs of all these wonderful plays or productions from 1960, almost up until the present. And a lot of the board members were fairly new to the Juneau Douglas Little Theater. We've all been involved in the last 10 years, and so we don't know who these people are in the photographs. So we're hoping that members of the Juneau community can help us identify some of these folks.
Now, when you get them all identified, do you have a plan? I mean, what are you going to do with the thing? You putting a book out?
No, we're actually going to be donating the collection to the Juneau Douglas City Museum.
Oh, okay.
We felt that they have the facility and capabilities to preserve it much more than our board has, and so we're going to be donating that to the museum. We wanted to help them with some of the research part beforehand.
What are some of the plays that you're going to be looking at pictures of?
That's another question. Some of them we don't know
what plays
they're from.
Okay.
No, there's one that's definitely a Charlie Brown.
You can tell by the yellow shirt,
yes,
right?
Yes, you can tell by the, it's black and white, but we can tell by the characters. They're like, oh, that's Charlie Brown. And then there's just, they had tons of productions. So I don't know what the actual names of them would be, but, there's Our Town, we've got scripts and playbills, and a lot of them we do have posters and playbills from. Mm-hmm. But again, we don't always know the year. We're realizing that a lot of times people don't put, on the posters and stuff, they don't put the year. They'll put the dates, but, not the year.
So you don't know when it actually,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
So we're trying to piece all these things together to come up with a more, just a more full history.
So now once this is finished and they donate it to the museum, what are you going to do with it?
Well, we're going to have it in our collection.
Okay.
So it will be a part of our collection at the Juneau Douglas City Museum, and it's It's very interesting. The Juno Douglas Little Theater actually received a grant through the City Museum to cull their items, to pull their items, all their photographs and everything, and they received money to have to purchase the archival to save these photographs. So it kind of came full circle. They used the grant to do this, and now they're donating the collection to the museum. So
did other people donate their pictures who weren't involved with the theater? Were these shots that people took while the play was playing?
Community members?
Yeah.
I believe they were cast members or people that were, you know, maybe some that attended.
Yeah, usually you're not allowed to take a picture during the play.
Right.
I was wondering if the secret cameras came out.
So my guess is that it was people that were either involved or, and there's definitely ones that are stage shots or, you know, headshots of the actors and actresses that are in it. So, yeah.
Wow. Hey, this is kind of cool. It reminds me of some of the PBS history television programs where they've taken still photos and moved on them to recreate a sense of history. It's that possibility exists here on a subject like this. You said at the beginning of the talk how long the theater had been in existence.
Yes. So the first play they did was Our Town in 1960.
Okay.
So. We're definitely over.
That you know was and you're sure of that?
Yes. We have, there was a history that was put together. It's not, it was kind of full, I think, at the point that she compiled it, but Connie Buchiro, who was one of the main folks at the beginning that got the Juno Douglas Little Theater started, put together kind of a brief history and what the plays were per season that they had done.
Were their productions all with local people, or did they import talent?
I don't know, but I know a lot of them did. It was mostly local people. I don't know if they had people from out of town in some of them. I think there are a few where there are some out of town folks that were invited to be part of it, but it was definitely a community theater group. They're also the ones responsible for doing Huccino and Hot Cakes, which ran for 14 years. And was part of the Gold Mine Tour.
Okay.
I think historically they're well known for that.
Interesting. Really an interesting topic. If someone is sitting out there and they're thinking, hey, I know something about that, how do they get in on this?
As far as actually coming and IDing,
just
show up tomorrow for the coffee and collections. We're going to have tables set up with the item and the collections out on the tables, and
don't spill coffee on the pictures.
Please be careful with your coffee.
Maybe you better have them drink the coffee over there.
Exactly. And then, hopefully maybe we'll get more people afterwards that know more information, and you can always contact us at the museum. So.
Okay, and again, the time tomorrow is?
The time tomorrow is from 10:30 to noon.
10:30 to noon.
And the museum opens at 10.
At 10, okay. So. And, of course, you don't have to pay to get in if you're coming
this
in to identify the photos.
It's a free program.
Okay, cool. Okay, so have a cup of coffee at the City Museum tomorrow. Put it down before you go look at the pictures that are spread all over the tables, and take a look and see if you can help them identify some of the folks that have been in plays by the Juno Douglas Little Theater that has been just 50 years ago, very shortly ago, they started their operation with Our Town. And we got all these images that we aren't quite sure who that was lurking stage left during the crucial scene and all like that. May have been just somebody who wandered in off the
stage. Never know.
Never know. Thank you so much for alerting us to this interesting activity for tomorrow. Thanks.
Thank you.
Pillars of America. On May 8th, hear Captain J. Charles Plum, a survivor of 2,103 days as a prisoner of war, tell his story of inspiration and courage in an upbeat, humorous, and dynamic style at the Pillars of America at Centennial Hall on May 8th. Tickets available at both locations of Hearthside Books, and lunches included.
This is Bird Note. Students in Jesse Soder's 4th and 5th grade class in Gustavus, Alaska, are studying the birds of their region. They've designed a year-long scientific study to figure out what plant communities have the most birds and other animals and why. They collect data on field trips and twice a week listen to episodes of Bird Note. Here's Jesse.
We saw some long-tailed ducks on one of our field trips, and so we wanted to learn more about them, and so I found an episode about long-tailed ducks, and we listened to that.
Her students delve into the Bird Note archive. Let's listen.
That's where I found that the spruce grouse, in the summer, it eats bugs and insects. And in the winter, all it eats is, like, spruce and needles. And that's pretty hard to digest, and it's not that rich in nutrients, so it has to eat a whole bunch. And its gizzard actually grows just to digest spruce needles.
And another.
I learned some stuff about a chickadee. When it goes to sleep, it shoves itself in a tiny little crack in a tree, and it drops its body temperature 18 degrees and shivers through the whole night to keep warm. And it's just amazing what birds do to survive.
Jessie Soder is bringing nature into her classroom.
I feel really strongly about helping students understand more about where they live. You know, I didn't know much about Bird Note when I first started using it, and we just started listening to episodes, and the kids loved it.
See photos of the project and share this episode with a teacher at birdnote.org.
Before 4 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News. If that music in the background is setting your toes to tapping, the people who make it are here in the studio with me. The McCrae Sisters, these are two of the folks who are part of the Folk Guest Dance Artists for the Folk Fest. Welcome to Juneau.
Thanks a lot.
I'm sure everybody in town has welcomed you before me, but anyway.
Yeah, very warmly.
So you're playing dance music, and I think you brought a Portland caller up with you too, right?
We did, yeah. We brought our friend Caroline Oakley.
I think she's going to be on the show in about 10 minutes.
Great.
So
when
we finish, then she is going to step in and kind of fill us in. So
great.
What opportunities do we have to dance to your music that are left?
Well, this Saturday we're playing a dance with Caroline, I believe at the, I can't remember the name of the hall,
Jack.
The Jack, yeah.
Yeah.
I believe that's tomorrow night.
Yeah, it's the Juneau Arts and Culture Center is where we get that interesting name. It has nothing to do with a guy named Jack.
Yeah, and then we're also doing a couple of workshops tomorrow and a couple of workshops on Sunday.
Oh, okay.
A wide variety of things.
So the workshops on Saturday that you're involved with are?
I believe it's a family dance and then a string band class workshop.
Which is, our Sophie, who's the other fiddler for the band, teaches a string band class in Portland with a couple other friends, and so this will be modeled after that. And that's where we'll teach one tune on different instruments. We'll split up into groups, and then at the end we'll come together and play the tune together. So it's a good chance to learn a new tune. But it's open to all different levels, you know, beginning to advanced.
And then Joanna's doing a clogging and step dancing.
Yeah, I'm doing a clogging workshop. It's like Southern Appalachian, like flat footing. I don't wear like wooden taps or anything like that. I just dance in cowboy boots, and it's a fun way.
Those aren't flat.
They are flat. Well, the front is flat. But it's a fun way to dance solo to old-time music. Square dancing is really great and wonderful, a wonderful way to experience the music, but buck dancing and flat footing is various names is a wonderful way to dance to it because it's solo and you don't have to have a partner.
Uh-huh.
It's also really high energy, which is fun. When you have a good high energy dance band, it's fun to really kick it up a notch.
So I guess the band was originally four sisters?
No, there are three sisters. So I'm one of them. Joanna here is the other. And then our older sister, Marion, who lives in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, is the other sister. And it actually started out with just myself and Marion. And so most of the CD that we have, Old Sledge, most of what's recorded on that is just banjo fiddle duets. Joanna's singing on some of it. But that was before Sophie joined the band. And Sophie's not a sister. She's an honorary sister.
Honorary sister, yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So these days it's two fiddles, banjo, guitar, and bass.
I guess one of the things I was wondering is if each of you has a birth sign, then does the honorary sister adopt the birth sign of the month she joined the band?
No, she's the balancing force. She balances out the sister dynamic a little bit.
Yeah.
She's the one that breaks up the fight,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Well, she's just very calm. She's a mediating influence, I would say.
And did you need that?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Well, when you have siblings that are as close in age as we are, it's there can be some friction.
It can be great, and it can also be terrible.
As it is with any band. I mean, I've heard so many stories from lots of folks who are in bands that aren't siblings. They're like, well, sometimes it was amazing, and sometimes we fought like you do.
Yeah. Now, it's I think any time art is the topic that there's so much invested in it that the emotions will eventually boil to the surface and witness the number of acts and bands that have broken up over the years over, what probably was a fairly trivial thing that started the whole thing, but then everyone hates each other and they won't get together for another 15 years before they do that.
Yeah, well, luckily, even if we break up as a band, we're sisters, so we can't exactly break up.
Yeah, definitely. And the only thing that's keeping us all from playing more regularly is that, well, Marion and Jamie do live in Philly, so it's a bit of a hike for band practice.
Now, a lot of your stuff is not dance. In other words, you do a lot of stage presentation and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it seems like, I feel like you kind of, I mean, old-time music by nature is a social music and a dance music. It's, a lot of these tunes, if we were just sitting and playing them by ourselves, we'd sit there and play them 10, 20 times around, and that might get kind of boring for people to watch. So, you change it, not change it, but, spice it up a little bit to play in front of a live audience. So we do more songs with words and mix in a little bit of early bluegrass stuff and try to make it a little bit more accessible to people that don't necessarily know old-time music too well.
Now, you were born and grew up for a while in Portland, Oregon, and then moved to North Carolina. Was that a family move, or did you all just decide you had to go down there?
Not all of us did. I moved first. I moved with a boyfriend at the time, and I was really interested in the music, and there was tons of it out there, and I'd met some really great folks out there, and I'd been traveling a lot, and just seemed to fit in, and it was a great place to just kind of soak it up and absorb it, and it's definitely the reason I went. And then
did Marion follow you?
Marion followed, yeah. She came out to visit me and met a lot of people, and then came out to work on a farm there for a summer, and then met Jamie, who now is her husband, and they ended up staying there. And so we both lived there for around 4 years.
Jamie's your bass player. No?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, he's not. Brian Bagdonis from Portland is playing with us this time, but Jamie's the regular bass player.
And then, did you join him down in North Carolina?
I spent a lot of time down there. I traveled down twice a year for probably four years.
Yeah, probably the whole time we were living there.
I spent many, many months, probably not quite a year down there, with all of the traveling that I spent through the years. But I never did live in North Carolina.
So now, part of what you were doing down there was absorbing the music, but I'm wondering how that works. I mean, did you hang out and jam with people, or were you going to dances and listening to bands?
There's a really great old-time jam that happens every week in Asheville at a place called Jack of the Woods, and it's an open jam. Started going to that, and there's just a really great scene of people there that were really welcoming, and so there'd be house parties, and I'd go to the jam, and then there'd be dances. And we have a really similar scene in Portland, actually. It's just really easy to just kind of get sucked into it, and, pretty soon it's all you're doing.
Yeah.
We all started doing square dancing originally. I didn't actually learn an instrument until I was 19, and I just would go to the parties just to dance, because it was that fun.
Not everyone would I guess express that way. It's interesting that you went after square dancing. It's a little atypical.
Well, when I started getting into folk music, our parents are musicians, but they're jazz musicians, and so we experienced some folk music, but not old time. And then in high school, Gabrielle and Sophie went to see a band called the Government Issue Orchestra, and they got into it and heard about these dances at the Kennedy School in Portland. It's an old elementary school that's been converted into a hotel, bar, restaurant, show space. And we started going and listening to Foghorn, Foghorn String Band, or Foghorn Leghorn, as they were at the time. And we all started going just because it was a fun, free all-ages event that you could do as a 15-year-old. And there was also a free monthly dance at a place called the Liberty Hall. We all really loved that. It was very, well-attended with young people who were heavily into the music and not wearing little outfits or, learning particular dances or moves, and you didn't have to have a partner and you didn't have to know anyone, and you just show up and somebody would be like, come dance with me. And it was great.
So is this both of you?
Mm-hmm.
And Miriam as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so and Sophie. Yeah.
Okay, so the four of you are kind of running around together.
Sophie and I went to high school together.
Without naming a year of birth or an actual age, what's the split? I mean, what are we, about 2, 3, 4 years apart?
We're all about a year and a half.
About a year and a half,
actually.
Yeah.
Okay. Sophie is Joanna's age.
Sophie and I are almost exactly the same age. Gabrielle is just a year and a half older than me, and then Marion is a year and a half older than her. So we're all pretty close.
It's because of the Folk Fest, it's become almost common here, but it's rather uncommon for a group of musicians in a family to form out of a family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people are often surprised. When I first started going down and visiting them in Asheville, people would say, oh, how do you know these guys? I'm like, well, Gabrielle and Mary are my sisters. And they're like, no, they're not. You guys aren't related. Yeah, we are, actually. Mm-hmm. And we actually enjoy spending time with each other.
Like many sisters, the two of you don't look alike.
Not that much, yeah. There's certain little things, but unless you've spent a lot of time with us and seen our little mannerisms, it's not that obvious.
Yeah. So, have you been to the Folk Fest up here before?
No. Actually. We've heard about it for years, so we're really excited.
What do you think?
Oh, man, it's amazing.
So much fun.
Yeah, we had a pretty incredible day today. We got taken to a glacier, and we went four-wheeling up the side of a pile of sand.
Yeah,
a giant sand.
Big pile of dirty pile. Sand stuff.
We saw some eagles.
We have a few of those.
Yeah, we went to the brewery and had a bunch of free beer samples.
Uh-huh.
And
we went and took a picture.
I wondered why you were so loquacious.
Yeah, well, I have to say I didn't drink because I don't drink beer. I know it's sacrilege, and most people would be shocked that I don't drink beer.
But, it's just been great. I mean, I'm really impressed by the festival. These guys helped put on a festival down in Portland, the Portland Old Time Gathering, and it's also all volunteer run. So you kind of know what goes into creating something like that, an event like this. And the fact that it's free and that it's got so many different events, and it's so inclusive also, just that so many people from the community are involved, it's really, really impressive.
The thing that I love the most about it is in 40 minutes or 50 minutes of music, you can see somebody who's next door to you.
Right.
And next act is someone who's got 19 CDs out on the market, and they're they're nationally known.
Right.
And then the next act is one of our school choirs or something like that.
Right,
so it's everything.
It's incredible. Okay. Yeah, and I mean, we've just been treated so well. So, I mean, this lady came to our door the other day with gift baskets. I mean, that's just really impressive, for a volunteer-run festival. It's really great.
I wish we could do something like that in Portland, but we generally have some 100-plus musicians, and then on top of that, several hundred volunteers, and it's a little bit.
Well, you could ship us all down there.
Yeah.
And we'd run it for you.
Yeah, have the Juno Folk Festival in Portland.
No, we have to have it here, but I'm sure we could put together a committee of 500 who would come down, particularly in the summer, when it was nice and warm.
The Portland Old Time Music Gathering is in January.
Okay, well. Not as good.
Not as good.
And we're all in Hawaii that month.
Yeah.
That's why you stay so cheerful.
Anyway. Yeah. Everybody is so happy. That's the thing.
Well, one of the things about Juno is you got to get out of Dodge once in a while.
And
the rain gets to you. Anyway, well, you've had a pretty good run of weather here.
Yeah. Well, it snowed more yesterday than all the snow we got in Portland over the winter. So that was exciting. We walked off the plane and we're like, oh my gosh, it's like Christmas.
Yeah.
The Christmas we never had.
Yeah.
And then today it's been so beautiful and amazing.
Yeah.
Really excited about it.
Let's take a quick look here at what is in your near future. They just put out the next level of the forecast. So tonight you can expect wind.
Mm.
So that's you're playing tonight, right?
No,
you're playing tomorrow.
Actually, we're probably going to sit in with
Rumblefish.
Rumblefish.
Okay, so if you're sitting in with Rumblefish, it'd be a big crowd because it's going to be too windy to stand around outside. So everybody's coming to dance.
All right.
And then Saturday we're looking at partly cloudy, highs around 45, northeast winds 10 to 20 miles per hour, wind gusts to 35 miles per hour in downtown Juneau, and out in the interior passes in the morning. And then Saturday night mostly clear. Looks like you're not going to get any more snow. You're probably leaving Sunday.
Monday, actually.
Monday. Yes. Okay, so Monday Monday night it'll be partly cloudy. Monday during the day it'll be sunny with highs around 44. So I hope you brought, sunning clothes, dark glasses, and the other things that are necessary for survival in June. Hey, let's go out with some of your music, shall we?
All right.
We've got one of the cuts off of your Old Sledge album, and this one is Wild Bill Jones, right?
Yeah.
Okay, let's take a listen. Thank you very much. It's about 13 minutes before 4 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next guest is a sort of party of what we were just listening to. The McRae sisters came up here from Portland, and on the way out the door, they said, oh, you got to come, you got to come. And so Carolyn Oakley, no, it didn't actually happen that way, but anyway, Carolyn Oakley is a fairly well-known musician and dance caller in the Portland area, and she is up here as the guest dance caller for the 39th Folk Fest. Hi.
It's true. Hi. How are you?
Well, pretty good. Welcome to Juneau, Alaska.
Oh, it's a great place.
This is Portland North, you know. It's
Portland North. Yeah. No, they're treating us very well up here.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. We'll pat them on the back for that.
Yeah.
So in Portland, you have a whole bunch of things going on. When did you get into calling?
So I got into calling. I'm a fiddle player.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, usually the front door or the back door to this kind of music and to the whole thing around it with the dancing, square dancing and everything. So I moved to Portland in 1999. I was playing fiddle and hooked up with the old-time musicians in town. And there is a gentleman named Bill Martin who was calling dances in Portland and had a weekly dance going. And I was going to all the dances and started talking to him about wanting to learn to call.
Hmm.
And so he took me and a couple other young callers under his wing, and we would get together and have little workshops at people's houses. You know, it's an interesting art form because you can't really woodshed as a caller, you need a bunch of dancers and you need a band to practice. You know, you can practice your calls, you know, in your living room as much as you want, but you really need live people to be able to actually all the logistics of working it all out. So we would get together and have these little gatherings and work on the calling, and a lot of it is the teaching, learning how to teach in a concise manner where you're not taking 15 minutes to teach a 5-minute dance. And then eventually he started letting us call at his dances. He'd say, you know, he'd call for the first hour or two and then invite us up to call a dance or two. And I made a promise to myself when I was learning to call that I would never turn down the opportunity to do it in public, no matter how terrified I was. And
were you?
And it worked. Oh, yeah. It's really scary because you don't know if it's going to work out, you know.
Yeah.
Are they going to listen? Are they going to like it? Are they going to be able to do what I'm trying to tell them to do, you know, is what's coming out of my mouth translating into this dance.
Mm-hmm.
But he would always stand behind me, and it was kind of like the kid that is learning to ride a bike, and you hold on and run along behind them and hold on, and then eventually they let go, and you don't know they let go, but you're doing it. So it's kind of like that, you know.
Yeah.
He would stand behind me so that I could ask him questions or get clarification, and then one time I turned around and he wasn't there, and I was like, okay. So I figured it out.
Yeah.
So I've gone from there.
When it goes bad,
right?
What form does it take?
You know, I think a lot of it depends on the personality of the caller, and that's one of the places where I feel like I'm lucky. And you know, you have some choices. So when it goes bad, it means they're not doing what I'm telling them to do,
yeah, okay.
And I'm needing to spend more time to try to re-explain to them how to do it.
Okay.
So you know, one choice is to jump ship and say, okay, this. I'm trying to teach you something that you're not ready for. So, but you don't want to say that. The baseball umpire. You don't want to admit that you made a mistake. You just want to be strong. So, at some point, it's like this fine line of, you know, I'm just going to let it go. And you guys, if you don't get it by the end of the dance, they're going to hear the music and they're going to be moving around and they're going to have a good time,
mm-hmm.
even if they don't figure out the figure. So, but that's one of the things that over time. You just get better and better at that. That isn't so hard.
Is the culture of this kind of dancing forgiving? I mean, if you screw up, are they going to?
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a party.
Yeah.
And
okay.
Everybody's going to the party.
Right.
You know, and so if you make a mistake, it's okay. It is very forgiving.
So I guess the flip side of that coin is, how does it feel when it's right?
It feels so good. I don't know. It's like everything's all locked into place. It's the same thing. I mean, it's like that.
I have to wait. Stop.
Okay.
I'm sitting here on the other side of this microphone, and I know the people who are watching this don't have pictures, but
right.
I have to describe what you did because it was wonderful. You looked up, and there was this look of like joy on your face that was really wonderful. I mean,
yeah.
You like what you do.
I love what I do.
It comes right across.
But it's like that feeling of flow that you get doing anything that you really love. And it could be cooking or gardening or fishing or riding your bike. And when you're really into it and you've forgotten about all your problems and what you have to do tomorrow and, you know, that kind of stuff, and you're just doing it and feeling it and enjoying it and
you're
being
right on
it.
The beat.
I mean,
the people are moving exactly where you expect them to be.
That's
and
what it is.
Your timing on the next call is just right on the click.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's, you know, there's off nights and on nights, but it's all good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are you going to do when are you calling here?
Okay. I called a couple dances last night. Tomorrow at 1:30, I'm teaching a workshop, a square dance calling workshop, and that will be whatever the people that show up to the workshop want it to be. So I have no idea if it's going to be a bunch of people that have never called before that want to learn how to call the dance, or if it's going to be other callers who want new material or new dances to learn. So, you know, I've done a little bit of prep, but really it'll be whatever they want it to be.
What they'll want is they'll want this guy who stands behind him and holds him.
Right. Holds their hand. Keeps him steady.
And then he ultimately is not there
anymore. Right. So ideally we'll be doing a lot of dancing and a lot of calling.
Okay.
And people will be learning new dances. And then tomorrow night, I should know the answer to this question. There is a dance somewhere in that program.
No problem. I got the program right here in front of me.
I would guess it's at the Jack. Cause I think all the
Saturday,
dances
are
there.
Everything's at the Jack.
Yeah.
But the dancing is in a separate... Heart.
Yeah, so it's...
And, oh, here we go. Saturday Night Dance. let's see, the McCrae sisters are on from 9:20 to 10:10 with caller Carolyn Oakley. You
that's
know her?
Me.
Yeah,
yep,
I thought that was her.
So that's it. So come out to that dance.
Okay, so 9:20 to 10:10.
Yeah, and really the McCrae sisters are such a fine, shining example of incredible dance music. And
I've been
when
listening
the music,
to their music all day on
yeah,
the show.
Yeah, when the music is good, then you can do whatever you want. It really makes the calling and the dancing so effortless.
So you know what you're going to teach tonight? Or tomorrow night
at the dance?
Yeah.
No. I mean, I made a list. I have a list of all the dances that I will call, and a lot of it is just what I feel like in the moment. You know, I always start with something simple just so I can read the crowd and figure out where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably one or two dances that I called last night that I would do again because they're so fun and just gems.
Yeah.
But I do wing it a lot. That's kind of my style.
What makes a dance a gem?
It's really easy to teach. And it's really fun to dance, I guess. Hmm. That sounds so simple. But, you know, I only like to teach dances that I really enjoy dancing. And there are a lot of dances out there that people request that I don't like dancing myself. And so I don't teach them. I don't do them that much, but I'll do them when people request them. So a gem for me is a dance that I love to dance and I love to teach.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I wish you great success with the dance tomorrow night.
Thank you,
And I hope everyone learns exactly the way you want them to learn and does exactly
and
what
I'll
you want
And I'll add
them
that this dancing is no experience necessary, all ages, all sizes. Come on out, and you don't need to know anything about anything.
Absolutely. Hey, terrific. Thank you very much. Cy Conn is the guest artist for the thing, and we're going to listen to a little of his music right now. Here's Cy Conn.
At the east end of town, at the foot of the hill, there's a chimney so tall that says Aragon Mill. And the only tune I hear is the sound of the wind as it blows through the town. Weave and spin, weave and spin. But there's no smoke at all coming out of the stack, for the mill has pulled out and it ain't coming back. And the only tune I hear is the sound as it blows through the town. Weave and spin, weave and spin. Now I'm due.
12 ensembles, 8 cities, 0 scripts. The Alaska State Improv Festival outstrips your imagination. Alaska groups and troops from around the nation, from New York to L.A., from Boston to Austin, at McPheeters Hall for 3 nights of inspiration, made up on the spot as you watch. April 18 to 20, shows at 7 and 9 p.m., tickets at Hearthside, The Jack, and The Door. Visit asifest.com for more. This message is brought to you by Morley Impoverished.
Tonight on 360 North, at 8, watch Breaking Ice for Arctic Oil. Author Ross Cohen looks at the 1968 voyage of the ice-breaking tanker Manhattan, providing an interesting historical reference point for marine traffic and resource development in the Arctic. In this week's Evening at Egan presentation, Great Decisions in Foreign Policy follows at 9:30 and Gavel Alaska resumes at 10. It's a great way to look at public affairs tonight on 360 North and 360north.org.
You're in tune with KTOO Juneau in Juneau, Alaska. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas, and we also broadcast on a set of translators throughout the area. In the Valley and Auk Bay, you can tune to K276 AF at 103.1 MHz. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, our signal clears up on K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS, broadcasting on 89.9 megahertz. In Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. KRNN is on digital channel 872 and will be live broadcast from the 39th Annual Folk Festival tonight. And KXLL can be found on 873. We're also online at www.ktoo.org. On Monday, the host for Juneau Afternoon is Joan Pardis. She'll have Kim Kiefer, the city manager, on to update us on CBJ activities. The STEM science camps are coming up. We'll have folks in to tell us about those. And Judith Morley will come in to highlight a quilt show at Centennial Hall. And the Juneau Roller Girls will be talking about their upcoming program on May 4th. So stay tuned now for All Things Considered.